Hey everyone, today we're taking a little trip right into the middle of your headspace, right into the brain. We're talking amygdala, we're talking prefrontal cortex, cognitive function, and all these interesting things. And my guests to guide us through this labyrinth of neuropathways is S.T. Rappaport. She is a brain coach, trained in the Feuerstein method, and someone who really understands how the brain works in terms of how we achieve things on a daily basis and how we can apply that to business. She knows how the brain learns, what will help us to learn more and absorb information faster, but also how to implement that and how to use our mindset and our cognitive functions to get more success in business and in life. Really fun conversation. I massively enjoyed this. Wish it could have been longer. She's going to share some incredible tips about how to increase your internal thermostat to achieve more success. Also, a few tips about what kind of content she's been using to very quickly grow her YouTube channel. So some tangible advice, some intangible stories from a really passionate and smart lady, S.T. Rappaport, here on Coaches to the Moon. I really hope you enjoy it. Let's get into it.
This is Coaches to the Moon, the only podcast you need to skyrocket your coaching business and create true impact on the world. Here's your host, Alex Morris.
Welcome back to the Coaches to the Moon podcast, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very excited because I'm already having a very fun conversation with our guest today, S.T. Rappaport, all the way out of Florida. She's staying up past 9 p.m., which is just unfathomable for me as a parent as to how she's doing it with a smile on her face, but we're so excited to have her here. Rappaport is a S.T., my apologies, S.T. is a brain coach, I'm looking at my notes to pronounce this properly, a Feuerstein mediator, which is something I'm really interested in learning about. I love her content, which is lots and lots of great information about how the brain learns, cognitive function, and lots of interesting things of that nature. Not being an expert myself, I'm going to quit while I'm ahead and say, ST, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much, Alex. I'm excited, really excited to be talking to you.
Well, that's good. Well, let's continue the conversation we were doing just before we started, because I want to dig into your backstory, that sort of thing. You've got some very, very interesting backstory that I want to dig into. But firstly, we were talking a little bit about the fact that at the moment, in the coaching industry specifically, I said something that I'm not afraid to say. I've said it a few times. I think that most of the coaching industry is bullshit. And that is because there's a lot of fake promises going out there. A lot of people giving out very, very short snippets of information saying, here's how I went from broke to now I'm in a pool with a laptop, that sort of thing. Or they're kind of selling a dream from very, very short form content. Or they're oversimplifying things an awful lot, which is great for marketing. But in terms of the way people learn, I think it's actually really ruining people's chances because they expect results too quickly. Now, you know how the brain learns, and that comes from your knowledge of the Feuerstein method, which is the skill of learning how to learn. So I'd just love to know from your perspective, how is there a correlation between the way people absorb social media content and then the way that their brain processes it and then creates these expectations in their lives that could be either detrimental or beneficial to their ultimate success?
Yeah, 100%. And it's going to be different for everyone. Now, honestly, if we think about this just in communication, okay, like let's take social media, I'll put it aside for a second. If two people are in the same room listening to the same person speak, they are going to have different takeaways. Why? Well, some people will say, well, it depends on their life experiences or their personalities. And like, that's true, but it's actually deeper than that. It depends on how their brain thinks and how their brain processes information, because thinking is not one big thing. Thinking is made up of 28 thinking skills, also called cognitive functions. And naturally, we all have stronger ones and weaker ones, but those differences in the strengths and the weaknesses is affecting how you are taking in and processing that information. So just like two people can be sitting in the same room and listening to a speaker give a really good speech and take away with different pieces of information, when people consume content, they are going to take it different. they are going to take it differently. But also, like you've mentioned many times on social, especially in short form, people give just a perspective. They give just a slice of the full story. You can't go and tell your entire life story and how you got here in just a 7-second video. So you give like, oh, these are the 5 things that I did, but you didn't say all the 100 things that you've tried that didn't work, and things like that. So we have to remember that we're just seeing a part of the picture and we're not really understanding the full story.
I mean, how good is that? Because, you know, you see overnight success, that sort of thing, that people have this astronomical rise to fame, where sometimes that is the case with maybe a reality TV star or someone whose video just blows up on TikTok now. It wasn't really a thing a long time ago. But most of the time, these people have been doing a lot of stuff in the background and then they negate that information in their content. So in terms of the way people consume, that's really, really interesting to me because the other thing about the coaching space as well, I think just the real social media, I'm in business, look at me space is like, look how many books I've got. Look how many books I read. I read a book a week, that sort of thing. And if you're not reading, you know, 10 pages of a book every morning, you'll never succeed. Now, ST, I have not read a physical book probably in 6 years. Having kids is part of that because I don't have that much time. And when we do have free time, I like to be with my wife rather than wrapped up in a book. However, I probably listen to about 2 hours of content per day. And I find that just so easy to do. Firstly, why do people have such affiliations with different styles of learning? And then also, is there truth to the fact that people say, oh, if you read something, you absorb twice as much as if you listen to it, that sort of thing?
So I'm going to answer your second question first. Okay. No, it's not true. It will depend on the person. Mm. What will work best is if you are listening and reading at the same time. So if you have a physical book and you're actually listening, because then you're actually using more parts of your brain. So yeah, you are going to remember it more. But you're not remembering something. The reason why it is easier for you to listen versus to read a physical book is because that skill is a muscle, and that muscle you have used more. So it is easier for you to take in information through listening. If you were not to listen for 6 years and just read books for 6 years, in 6 years' time, that's what's going to be easier for you. So back to that question, do you remember more one way or the other? You're going to remember more the way that your brain is currently used to learning. Now, that's not to say you shouldn't learn the other way. I'm a very big believer in like working with your brain. So if you want to learn, then like read through reading. But if you want to challenge your brain, which we all should be doing to keep our brains young, then purposely do things that are challenging and purposely go things that like it might feel like you're not remembering the information, but just for the sake of the challenge to go do things that feel a little bit harder.
Love that. Love that. I think the book thing for me is not, obviously I can read, and we'll get onto your story about that skill in just a minute. And I used to love it when I was a kid. My mum's always like, you know, you never read anymore. You used to love to read. And I think my answer to that would be like, I used to love to read when my only responsibilities would go to school and then read a book, you know, not kind of wake up in the morning, look after 2 toddlers, then handle my 13 staff and 3 dozen clients, and then get into my podcast and then try and stay fit and somewhere cook dinner, you know. I think that's probably why I don't read that much, but it's just, yeah, that's really interesting. So I suppose that if I really got into, that's fully true, isn't it? When you're absorbed in a book on holiday, you know, then all you want to do is get back to that book. Not just because of the storyline potentially, but you're thinking that it's actually you know that your brain is becoming trained to absorb material that way. Very interesting indeed. Now, you've mentioned in your sort of podcasting pre-work that you couldn't read properly up until you're about 10 or 11 years old, which is really interesting to me. What do you mean you couldn't read properly? At what level were you reading?
I don't know if there was like a grade level, but I really, really struggled with it. It was a very big challenge for me. I found ways to manage, like, and to work around it. So I would still read books. I'd read much lower kids' books, but I would skim a lot. So I skimmed tons. I had a really low vocabulary because of that, because anything that was hard, I just skimmed over. Mm-hmm. And reading out loud, where I actually had to read properly, like that, I couldn't do at all. So like anytime a teacher would call on me, like I would just like not read, or I would just like say it really quietly. And like they knew I went to reading tutors all those years. Spent a lot of time out of the classroom with these reading tutors, and that I liked because I didn't like school and I liked being out of the class. But my parents weren't too happy about it, so they decided they had to do something else.
How interesting. And it wasn't dyslexia or anything like that?
Yeah, I got tested for like a whole bunch of things. I still think I still have like a trait of like some sort of dyslexia in some way. Still like will mix up letters and words, even my writing and reading. But no, it wasn't like officially diagnosed like that.
Interesting. You know who Jamie Oliver is? No. The Jamie Oliver chef. He's like, he's the biggest celebrity chef in the world besides Gordon Ramsay probably. And he's kind of English and he's a bit like me. And, he in England is the highest non-fiction, highest selling non-fiction author in the history of England. He never read a book until he was like 40 years old, because he's dyslexic, kind of got like massive ADHD, that sort of thing, just really struggles. But his first, he tells a really cool story that his first novel he ever read was when he was like 41, because he saw the first Hunger Games movie. And then really wanted to know what happened next. But the movie wasn't out yet, but the book was. So that's the first book he ever read. And it's just funny that the reading thing, obviously massively important skill, but maybe there's a point you can get to where it doesn't become so necessary anymore. But what are, in your mind, now that you've done it, what are the benefits of developing that skill further, getting better at reading, improving your vocabulary? And how have you seen that change in your life?
Yeah, so for me, it wasn't so much about the reading. It was more about what I did to the reading, which I know we'll get to in soon. But even in today's world, where like technically you could manage without reading and everything could be like spoken out loud to you. And I don't like anything that you're like limiting yourself and you have to like build a way around, or build like a whole system around yourself, is literally putting some sort of ceiling on you, because you are going to come into times where you need to read, or you have to miss out on something because you can't read. And I'm a believer in like challenging your brain, like I just said, and not like saying like, oh, it's too bad I have dyslexia, so I can't read. No, there are ways for you to read. You might have to learn different ways, but there are ways for you to read. But I am going to note, when he was determined to read his story, what's his name again? That guy?
Jamie Oliver.
Yeah, Jamie Oliver. Then when he was determined to read that story, he was able to read the book. So there's a determination, like, will allow you to be able to do anything. And if only someone would have been there to help him be able to find earlier, I'm sure he would have been able to read earlier.
Determination will give you the ability to do anything you want to do. That's really interesting. Let's bring this into business a little bit, because in the coaching space, in any business space, we're not short of content teaching us how to run a business. You can pay someone or go for free on YouTube, come to a podcast like this, and find the exact steps to do the thing that you need to do. But what I find is that when I talk to my clients, for example, for context, and I say what you need to do to generate some interest in your business is give away something for free, and then just like talk to the people who download it. For example, like a lead magnet, for example, here's the exact 5-step process to create a highly converting Facebook ad for coaches. And they say, but if I give them this thing for free, then they're not going to want to pay me because they've already got the information. And then my answer is always, they haven't paid for it, they're not going to do it, basically. Now, do you think that there's much more, I suppose, chance of someone learning a skill deeply if they have a higher commitment to it, whether that's physical, financial, emotional, spiritual. Is that a factor in how well people learn and implement things?
100%. When you're motivated to something, and it doesn't make a difference what that motivation is, but the motivation creates that commitment, your cognitive functions, your 28 thinking skills actually go up. Like, your performance in those 28 thinking skills go up. So it's easier for you to learn, it's easier for you to implement, and you're just going to do it. Also, when you're committed, like, it's not just like, oh, something that I find interesting, but you're committed.
Yeah.
You're going to make it happen.
Is there a point that you know of where commitment, you know, kind of flips over and determination, such as, like, if you're trying to get yourself out of a financial hole by succeeding in business, you know, you've quit your job to start your business, and then you're motivated, you're determined. But is there a point where that flips and you get so stressed that then your cognitive abilities and decision-making abilities actually deteriorate? Because I found that in my business was like when I was going all in, burning the boats, like Tony Robbins style, back against the wall. I can't do anything else. No plan B, like that kind of coaching stuff. I was, that's when I was making the worst decisions in business, because I was like desperate for wins.
Notice what you just said. You said you were desperate. That's the difference. Yeah. Once desperation comes in, then you're working from like a survival mode. Mm. And once you're working from survival mode, your brain literally shuts down and it's trying to survive. And so you can't think. Like, that's why, like, when we get into fight or flight type of things, or like we're feeling like super anxious, your brain literally can't think. That's why, you know, toddlers, like when toddlers have a tantrum, whatever you tell them, like, they're just not listening to you. Their emotional brains, their amygdala, actually like overtakes their whole brain, and you just can't talk to them. You first have to be able to calm down and get out of that state in order for you to think. So going back to your question, yes, if you are desperate and it's coming from a very survival state, you're not going to be making your best decisions. So you would want to find something to help you right now, so that way there's food on the table and then you could actually make the decisions that you need to for your business.
Okay. So in high stress jobs, that sort of thing, like, you know, you see people, CEOs of big companies, and you watch shows like Succession, or even I'm fascinated by Donald Trump. I'm sure he's still running businesses while he's under all this, you know, pressure. How does he get up and make a decision about what to do with a real estate deal when he's on the verge of going to prison? I suppose if you build a capacity, like you talked about with reading, if you build a capacity for dealing with higher pressure, is that kind of like a muscle in the brain as well that will allow you to make decisions and delay that fight or flight mode?
Yeah. Have you ever heard of like the whole brain?
No.
Imagine for a second, this is your brain. Okay. For people listening, take your hand and put your thumb in the middle of your finger. This is called your amygdala. This is where your high emotional states are. You could teach this to kids also. They like totally love us. Okay. Now this front part, this is like the amygdala is two like tiny little almond size parts of your brain where, like I said, they're the emotion, like very high emotions, a lot of memories are there. Now these four fingers on the top are your prefrontal cortex. Like that's in the front of your brain where your forehead is. Okay. Now for those of you listening, my thumb is inside and my prefrontal cortex, my four fingers are bent over. Most of your day, as you're going about your day, your prefrontal cortex and your amygdala are having a conversation with each other, and they're talking to each other and they're figuring out what to do. And your prefrontal cortex is running the show and making decisions. Okay. If you have what's called an amygdala hijack, tons of emotion flooding in, a 2-year-old has a tantrum about something, someone gets triggered by something, emotion, whatever, just tons of stress, you get what's called an amygdala hijack, and your four fingers, your prefrontal cortex flips up. There is literally a disconnect between your amygdala and your prefrontal cortex, between your emotional brain and your thinking brain. There's like a distance. There's no way for them to communicate within each other. In order for you to be able to communicate back to each other and to have your prefrontal cortex running the show again, you have to do stuff to calm your brain down. So deep breaths, a run, all the typical ways that everybody talks about calming yourself down will bring it back down, and then your prefrontal cortex can run the show again. Now, the more times you do this, the more times you calm yourself down and you count to 10 instead of yelling and things like that, you tighten the ropes, so-called, between your prefrontal cortex and your amygdala. And so it gets stronger. So like you said, like that muscle, you can deal with a lot more stress because that muscle is stronger.
Wow. Look at that. That's super cool. That's so a physical distance, not like an emotional distance, like, you know, oh, my wife's distancing herself from me. Like a physical distance, but your brain changes.
Your brain doesn't move, but like the messages can't go between like in the neurons. Yeah.
That's bonkers. How cool is that? How cool is that? A lot of big words that you need to learn when you get into this. You know, I don't have to learn many big words in my field of work, which is nice. And when I get into the techie part of it, I avoid talking about it and hire people to do that. Amygdala, prefrontal cortex. You're doing very, very, very good work.
Emotional brain, thinking brain. Keep it simple. Teach it to your 2-year-old.
Well, you know, you were just talking about tantrums. One of my daughters, she has like monster tantrums, and she had one last night. We started off just a little disagreement and then just blew up because she didn't have a nap yesterday. She was tired from daycare. She's got like a bit of rash, you know. And for some reason, I'm really good at dealing with her when she's in that full meltdown mode. But I really struggle when she's just being belligerent with me, when she's kind of when it's on the way and she's just refusing to do stuff. That's when my wife has to, she's a childcare teacher, she knows how to talk to a toddler and reason with her. But when it goes past that point, we have to swap, because I can deal with a rolling around, you know, uncontrollable, can't talk to her at all, and my wife can't deal with that so much, which is very interesting. And I wonder if it's her capacity, you know, her mind muscle in terms of, you know, the reasoning side of it and the patient side of it, and then my mind being more accustomed to a different kind of stress, which is interesting. Do you deal with a lot of parents in your brain coaching and helping them with dealing with their kids?
Currently, I deal with entrepreneurs only, but a lot of them have kids. Originally, when I started this, I did this with kids, and so I dealt with the parents also.
Oh, wow. So you started off by doing brain coaching for kids?
Yeah. Yeah. Not 2-year-olds. Usually it was 5 and up, but most definitely had to deal with parents and schools, and that wasn't my favorite thing.
Amazing. Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine it's not, because I suppose that the kid is essentially the client, but as they're not a decision maker, then the parent becomes involved, sticking their beak in a little bit. Is that what that was like?
Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't say this, like some of the parents were amazing and they were like willing to do anything for their child and were growing. That a big part of it was like having that growth mindset of like being able to try something new and something different. But some of the parents just wanted to give their kids a magic pill and see everything be perfect overnight.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to do that. So.
No. Yeah. So, I mean, and I don't want you to make any rash claims right here on the podcast, ST, but the brain coaching that you're doing, the brain engineering that you can do with kids and potentially even adults, is it a possible alternative to medication?
100%. Okay. Yes. I actually have like what's like a 3-day intensive where I have clients come, like we work 1-on-1 for 3 days, do very specific exercises. If you want, I could share with you the type, but it gets very sciencey. and literally by the end of it, they're like focusing way better. A lot of them go off meds after that. I'm not a doctor. You have to like afterwards work with like, I'm not telling you to do in that way, but a lot of them end up being able to go off after.
That's fantastic. Really, really exciting. What a, are you, I mean, from a marketing standpoint, do you ever run any ads for your business?
No.
Okay. Cause it's really interesting. Like, the sort of stuff you're saying, like, I can help people get off their meds. You can say that on organic content on your website.
Right.
You cannot put that in a Facebook ad. You can't make any sort of medical-based claims like that. It's really, really discouraged. You get flagged. You get your account disabled. And so whenever we get someone with who can make, you know, and back up claims like that, then we've got to figure out a way of saying it without saying it. Like when we've got, especially when we get into the fields of weight loss, that sort of thing, even if you've got an amazing track record for helping people lose weight, you can't say it. Because this,
you can say like weight loss, like the term
weight
loss.
You can't say weight loss. You can't say like, you know, on average our clients lose X amount of, you know, pounds or kilos. Yeah, it's really, really interesting. If you ever got into paid advertising, you'd find all this red tape that you're not allowed to cross.
Oh gosh. Okay, good to know.
Yeah. Once they're in the process, you can do whatever you like. But you'd have to tiptoe around it a little bit, which can be really annoying for some coaches with really specific styles of knowledge like yourself. So speaking of marketing, you mentioned to me, I said that I loved your YouTube channel, which is really great, which it's just your name, right? ST Rappaport?
Or Life Picks University.
Life Picks University.
Will come up.
They both work, yeah. And I said it looks great. And how long have you been doing it for? And you said only really seriously for the last few months. And you've got, you know, over 1,000 subscribers very quickly, which is great. What have you found to be your most useful style of content to create? And what have you found to be your best style of content to create in terms of engagement, growing the channel, and having conversations with your audience?
Yeah, so I'm going to start. The reason why I didn't do this for a very long time was because I didn't want another thing that required a bunch of production. So if you've seen any of the videos, there's zero editing, there's zero anything, and it's working so far, at least. So I'm just saying that for whoever needs to hear that. But the thing that I found works best is something that is obviously related to what I talk about, but is very related to many people with a slight controversial twist, a little bit like we were talking about, like getting off meds type of things, and fully being able to back it up. That gives place for a lot of conversation, for people to ask questions, for people to be more interested and like download lead mag in it and things like that.
Okay, sweet. So kind of a bit of controversy, and a topic that maybe has strong opinions about it. Is that?
Yeah. But okay. It doesn't have, I don't want to say, like, there's a lot of, like, talk about this on, like, controversy. And, like, it doesn't have to be, like, a big, bold claim. It just has to be, like, something slightly different and not what everyone else is talking about. And when it's just phrased correctly, which I'm still learning, but when it's just phrased correctly, then, like, it hits people slightly differently.
Can we have a couple of examples of things that have done really well for you?
Let's say, for example, one video was, like, people aren't bad. And so that was like the title of the video. A big thing I'm big into is not like, this is what you should do, but like, here's how I do it instead. And how's I approach it. And so I spoke about the fact that people aren't bad and they may be doing bad actions. But there's a reason why they're doing a bad action. And if you're in the position to help them, a parent, coach, something, then it's your job to help them not be mad at them that they had this bad action, but to actually help them be able to solve it.
Amazing. Why do you think it is? Kind of, I'm not sure if this is something that, you know, falls into your area of expertise, but you seem like a very smart person. Why do you think it is that sort of more negatively inclined content gets so much more attention than stuff that is positive?
Yeah, it goes like back to like the news, right? Like the news always wants something negative. And it's not even just with the words we use, it's also with the pictures we use. If you put a picture of just you smiling there, it doesn't do as well as like some sort of like surprised or like mad face of some sort. It's because I don't know, this is just like literally a guess, like a theory. But I think part of it comes to curiosity and part of it comes to survival. So it's much more curious to like, to be like, why is someone really angry? Like if you hear two people like fighting or whatever, like you want to hear like what they're talking about. That's like a lot more curious than if like you just see like a happy couple having a conversation at a coffee shop. And then second, on the survival side, like if this is something to be worried about, is this something to have to like take like from a survival perspective, then like your brain antennas like pick up and like want to watch it.
Yeah, got it, got it. So do you think it goes back to, you know, that survival thing again? It probably goes back millions of years once again to if you hear a breaking stick behind you in the forest, then that's going to attract more attention because potentially there's danger. And now that we don't feel, you know, now that a couple arguing over there doesn't really create danger for us, but we're still intrigued by it, by our nature, but now there's not as much danger on a daily basis. How interesting.
Yeah. And I think this is like, you have to be a little bit careful because like you said in the beginning, how a lot of people make a lot of claims and there's a lot of things of where this goes. I was like thinking a lot about it recently actually, and how I think my guess would be is that the original people that started it or whatever the original people are, right? Like when social media came out or at some point, people didn't, it didn't jump to where it was right now. People just did like tiny, tiny little tweaks. And these tiny, tiny little tweaks eventually came to what the coaching industry is right now. And I think the same thing will happen with YouTube and the same thing will happen with all other areas of social media and just this world in general. So it's just something to like look out for and be aware of.
Totally. I mean, I find myself so guilty of it. Like I find myself, you know, you go on a, if there's something that is annoying you, whether it's like politically or whatever, and there's, then you will go to a video that makes you angrier about it. You know, that kind of, you know what I mean? Like if there's something, someone said something or some laws happened or some event, then you won't search for the thing that will mediate your frustrations. You will say, you will type in like, what's an example? Like, you know how everyone blew up about, I don't know if you've seen everyone blowing up about the whatever Disney's doing, Disney remakes, you know, Disney remakes of old cartoons that we all grew up with as kids. And what people do is they go like, you know, new Snow White movie, and they won't click on positive review, they'll click on the negative one, and then and then they'll go down a rabbit hole of all these reasons why that movie sucks, that sort of thing, and
just makes them more angry.
exactly. So I think that's really interesting, but I also think that there must be something in it that for entrepreneurs, maybe like it's almost that self-sabotage thing that the reason so many people don't succeed in business is they get themselves hooked into a habit or an idea that is not helpful, and then they do more of that instead of, because it's almost easier to do the negative habit, like, you know, harmful addictions, that sort of thing, than to do the work which will help you get out of it. So I wonder, is the sort of self-sabotage thing something that you see a lot in entrepreneurs that you work with? And is there anything to do with actually how our brain works, or is that more of a habitual thing?
Yeah, it most definitely has to do with how your brain works. And it has to do a lot with like our inner thermostat. Have you ever heard of it?
In various ways, but I'd love to hear your ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. So we each have like, just like if you have a thermostat in your house and you set it to a certain degree, as soon as, let's say, the door opens and it becomes colder, it's going to readjust the temperature to go back to the temperature that you've set. So we have inner thermostats for everything. We have inner thermostats for weight. We have inner thermostats for how much money we make, for how many clients we have, for like literally everything. Unless you consciously do something about it to change that thermostat level. That's why so many people hit plateaus in certain weight, in any area of that, what they're trying to work. And that's where it comes into like the self-sabotaging, because if they've made, let's say, X amount of money and they're trying to make more, they're going to keep on finding ways to self-sabotage themselves to only stay at their inner thermostat level.
Okay, sweet. That makes a lot of sense. And I can definitely see that happening. You know, saying I want to make 10 grand a month in my coaching business, then maybe you have a 15 grand a month, you go back to 10 because that was always your goal. I get it. Okay, sweet. So first part of my question for that one is that when people come into you to talk to you with a really ingrained internal thermostat about how successful they can be, what sort of methods can they use to increase that thermostat and open themselves up to more clients, more money, more success, more healthy relationships, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So the very first thing is you want to make sure you have a growth mindset.
Okay.
Carol Dweck, a psychologist in Stanford University, she wanted to know what makes a person successful. Sports, money, relationships, anything. Like, what makes a person successful? And she discovered it has nothing to do with IQ, talents, where you're born from, any of it. It has to do with whether you have a fixed or growth mindset. Fixed mindset believes the way they are is the way they're always going to be. Growth mindset is not just like always learning, but is like everything is about the learning, right? Like, they're purposely putting themselves in challenging situations to learn. When they get feedback, they're using it as learning. They're focusing a lot on the process because that is part of the learning. It's not just the outcome. So first of all, by developing a growth mindset, which you can do like by simply changing your words. So if you're saying, I can't make this much money, and then you are having a fixed mindset about it, you want to